Throughout the year, we drink NC wine, cider, and mead. Whether you join us for an event, plan a visit to your local winery, cidery, or meadery, or enjoy a meal at your favorite restaurant perfectly paired with NC wine, anytime is a great time to get out and give love to your local maker. To plan your trip, download the NC Wine app or visit ncwine.org.
Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Matt. We're the NC Wine Guys. Welcome to Cork Talk.
In this episode, we sit down with Jan Olson from Ferncrest Winery in Andrews, North Carolina.
At Ferncrest Winery, they're trying to be good stewards of the environment. Jan tells us about how they focus on the environment in all aspects of their business.
Wine Class with the Wine Mouths is back. Join us as Jesse and Jessica take us through the next chapter in the history of wine.
This episode is made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council. You can learn more about the council by going to their website, ncwine.org.
So sit back, pour a glass, and listen.
All right, so we are here today at Ferncrest Winery in Andrews, North Carolina, with Jan Olson. Jan, welcome to Cork Talk.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So tell everyone a little bit about Ferncrest, how it got started, and what's going on in Andrews, North Carolina.
Okay. Well, how it got started is I had met Kurt, and he was making a lot of wine from Kitts, and he was also making some really good beer. And I was looking at property up here as a retirement area. And we found this property that was perfectly south-facing, which both of us just agreed was very much where we wanted to live because we were both very much into renewable energy homes.
Oh, cool.
And so we put the small vineyard down below on a steep slope on the south-facing and then built the house and the winery up above. So that's kind of how we got the land. How we got started was we started talking about, well, I wanted to come up here as quickly as possible after the land was bought. And he was like, you know, we're really too young to totally retire. So what are we going to do? And I was always loved wine and we were making lots of wine kits. We were like at 10 to 12 a year that we were making, but we were also aging them. It wasn't like we were like drinking them up.
Right.
And all the reds were, we were aging for like 2 years before we'd open the bottles. Uh-huh. And the whites we were, you know, within a year, we were starting to drink those. And we decided to start talking to people that were in the wine industry, not just go to wineries, but actually talk to them and find out the different business models and find out if they had to start over again, what type of equipment would they start with, and you know, what kind of building would they build, and just all the little nitty-gritty things that you need to know when you're going to build from scratch. So that was very, very helpful. And one of the times that we were there, we met Amy Hilton. And she was like, oh, you need to join the North Carolina Wine Growers Association. So, of course, we joined the Wine Growers Association and took some classes, went up to Surrey, took some of their seminars. And basically, that's how we got into the wine business. And one of the reasons is because I've always liked wine, but not just that. Because it's a friendly business. There's no competition.
Right.
Because if you don't like my wines, that's fine. Go to my neighbor. Go to the winery down the street. Go to the wineries in Yakima Valley. You will find a wine in North Carolina that you love. So, you know, I try to have something for everybody's taste, but if I miss the mark, that's okay.
Yeah, that's a story we hear in talking to a lot of folks it's particularly the local wine industry, but I don't think that's unique to North Carolina. I think that's kind of the way it happens in other areas too. So when the vineyard is at your home, right. And then so what varieties did you plant initially there?
Well, we planted there the Chardonnay, which is a hybrid out of Cornell University, Vidal Blanc, another hybrid, and then Cynthiana, also known as Norton, which my husband fell in love with that wine when he was out in Missouri. He was stationed out there. So those were what we planted then. And then here at the tasting room, we've planted Castile, which is a blending grape that's out of the University of Minnesota. And it's a very early ripening. I mean, it'll be ready to pick by the end of next week.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And that's actually a cool thing, too, because as you said that, I looked out the window and I'm like, oh, yeah, there are grapevines out there. Oh, yeah, that's an actual vine. It's not just, you know, shrubbery or a nice topiary. It's actually productive and works toward you.
So that's right. Great. And it's a very dark, inky grape, and we have been using it to color. We did last year, used it to color our Catawba. And we work with about 9 different vineyards that are in the local area, from Asheville down to Dahlonega, Georgia. So we buy a lot of our grapes.
And for listeners who don't know, it may sound strange, we're talking about 2 different properties. So the vineyard and the winery are not at the tasting room here. So your tasting room is situated in downtown Andrews.
That's right. And we did that for 2 reasons. One reason is because we're on a single-track dirt road. And although it's not a very long single-track dirt road, it is a curvy single-track dirt road. And somebody's backing up if you meet another car. And we just didn't want to have the liability of someone trying to get to the winery and some trying to leave from the winery and meeting on that road. And the other thing is that we just love this property. We've got lots of off-street parking, and we get a lot of people who just are driving by and see it and say, oh, I think I'll stop. Let's stop and have some wine.
Yeah, I mean, Andrews is a cute little mountain town, and so having the tasting room downtown, I think, is a good fit. And then with those grapes right out front.
That's right.
Yeah, you really
tells everyone what this place is.
Exactly. Exactly.
So talk to us a little bit about the name Ferncrest. Where did that come from?
Well, the name came from the fact that my husband's first job out of college was being a state naturalist. And being the type of person that he is, he can't just go out in the woods and show people things and say, here's a tree, here's a flower, here's a fern. He had to know what they all were specifically. I go out, on the other hand, into the woods and I go, oh, look, there's a fern. He'll go, that's a Christmas fern. I say, oh, that's nice. So then we'll walk a little while later and I'll say, oh, look, another Christmas fern. No, dear, that's a wood fern.
So he's like a walking picture it app, right? The,
exactly.
The app on your phone that you can take a picture of a plant and figure it out.
And then the other thing is that when we moved into a house in Lilburn, Georgia, we had a landscape that was all understory, and he wanted to put in ferns. Well, the first thing he thought of was, well, I'll just grow them from spores.
Oh.
You know how long it takes to grow ferns from spores? Well, the last group that he did, which was an Australian tree fern and elkhorn ferns, took him 2 years.
Oh, my gosh.
So you have to have a lot of patience. And that's a good thing, because making wine takes a lot of patience.
Yes, true.
And then the house and the winery are out on a crest of the hill. It's actually a saddle. And so we just put the fern and the crest together, and we got Ferncrest.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very interesting logo. It's definitely looks like a crest, and then you've got the picture of the fern on it, so it all works together. And
right.
And really, then the mountains on the top.
Right, and the mountains are the Snowbird Mountains. You know, the first time we had this drawn for us, they had these real huge peaks, and I'm like, no,
we're in Western North Carolina. They're tall, but they're not the Rockies.
They're not the Rockies, right. So that's how the logo came about.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, we had fun doing that.
And I think the ferns also go into a lot of the names of the wines that you have. And we're going to talk
all
about
of the
wines.
All of the names are for ferns. Awesome. And I get to pick out the fern names.
Is it easier for you to tell which wine is which wine versus which fern is which fern now?
Yes. Okay. I can associate the fern names with the wine. I still can't associate the ferns with the names of their ferns. There's only 2 that I can identify at site. One is a cinnamon fern, because it's huge.
Mm.
It likes wet areas, and it has this big stick that looks like a cinnamon stick in the middle. So that's why it's called a cinnamon fern. And then the other one is the southern maidenhair, which just kind of looks like a hand that's been drooped down.
Mm.
It's usually on the side of the road.
Huh.
Wow.
Well,
okay.
I'm looking for those on the way out today.
Yeah, for sure.
We have
sure.
Them here.
So talk about kind of what people could expect when they come to visit.
Well, what people can expect when they come to visit is we still do tastings. There's a lot of places that I know of that have gone away with tastings. Mm-hmm. Yep. We also do flights for those people that just want to do a flight. We carry a lot of local products. So we have cheeses that are from Ashe County. We have sausages that are from a company that's outside of Charlotte. We have some fermented vegetables that mm-hmm. are from a lady who's in Asheville. We have nuts that are from North Carolina that are done here. We have jams and jellies that are done by ladies that are here in Andrews, as well as a lady who's done over in Murphy. So we're trying to support local businesses in addition to having our wines. And the other thing is that this is a really nice space. We have lots of plants, and everybody's always amazed at how well the plants do in this building, but it has just the right light for them.
Right.
And they just love it here.
And I see all the Christmas cactuses.
And all the Christmas cactuses. But we also have ferns here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Various types of ferns.
Yeah. Wow.
And other things. Some of these plants I tried growing at the house, and they just didn't get the right amount of sun, and I brought them here and they all prospered. So
yeah, you've got a lot of good sunlight coming in, and so yeah, and it adds to the ambiance of the tasting room for sure.
Right. And then we have a large outdoor area that we just put up solar panels there. We have solar panels and solar voltaic, as well as solar hot water at the house, and we use that for the winery as well as the house.
Oh, cool.
And we've just put solar panels and a stage outside here. And we're very pleased with the way the solar is performing.
Good.
That's good.
And I think there's some other events that maybe take place in town that you can play off of as well.
Mm-hmm. We have twice a month during the late spring through September, we have Food Truck Fridays. And then we do a spring fling in April. We do Oktoberfest. This year it's going to be September 30th. And then we do a Christmas on Main, which is the weekend before Thanksgiving. So we have a lot of things that are going on in Andrews that bring people from all over the Southeast especially. Lots of things to do here. And now we have a new attraction, which I will call an attraction. It's called Rail Tours. And they are four-seater bikes. Mm. Now they can be operated with two people or three people or four, so it doesn't have to have four people. And those are motor-assisted, and you go about 5 miles up to a hand-dug tunnel that was done in 1890s.
Oh, wow.
And spend a little time up there and then come back. And we're working on Andrews Chamber of Commerce is, there's an Andrews Trails group who are looking to add some trails from there to go up to Rodeo Falls, put a path there right now. Right now it's difficult to get up there.
Mm.
And that's right by the tunnel.
Sounds cool.
It is cool.
Yeah, lots of nature around as well. So
exactly.
Hiking, biking.
Yep.
Yeah. And you're not that far from the Nantahala Gorge either, right?
No. Well, we're really situated in between the Nantahala and the Ocoee Gorge. So if you like whitewater rafting.
Perfect spot to come.
Perfect spot to come. Exactly. Exactly. For the beginners, Nantahala. For the advanced, the Ocoee.
So your mix, so people that come in, is it mostly local folks, or you get a lot of tourists that are in the area too, or is it kind of both?
It's kind of both. We get a lot of locals who come in. I have a lot of locals who come in routinely. But I have people who come back to this area to go vacationing. They either have a home here, or they have a friend who has a home here, or a parent that has a home here. And they come back every year or several times a year, and they always come in. I have people who are from here but have left, but they have family reunions, and they all come. They come back year after year. We have a number of wedding venues here that are just beautiful. They're destination wedding places, and they come here and have wine, or sometimes I go up there and do a wine tasting for them.
Oh, cool.
After they've bought the wine, I go up and introduce the wines to them.
Nice. And like the full service.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Sounds like you probably meet a lot of interesting people and hear a lot of interesting stories and share something too. Mm-hmm. So very cool.
Yeah.
So we're actually at a good spot to take a quick little break for our wine education segment. But when we come back, let's spend a little bit of time about talking about the grapes that you grow, the vineyards, and then moving into the wines themselves.
Okay.
It's time again for Wine Class with the Wine Mounts. Jesse and Jessica, welcome back.
Thanks.
So we're somewhere in like the mid-1900s or something.
Yeah, and we're just going to stay there.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Because I feel like it's still the 1900s. We were born in the 1900s.
Yes, we were. Yeah. But the late 1900s.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
yeah. Some of us later than others. But, you know.
We're at least past World War II now.
Yeah.
Mm, okay.
So we're in the 50s and 60s tonight.
All right.
So moving into the 1950s, well, let's first begin our journey in Australia. And it's at this point that I wish that I could do an Australian accent, but I'm not even going to try. You guys deserve better than that. So, but we're first going to focus on a man named Max Schubert.
Not James Bugsby or whatever?
No.
He finally died, maybe?
Yeah. Thank you. Well, he moved to New Zealand, and then who knows?
But Max Schubert, in 1950, he was traveling around the world, and while he was in a sherry cellar in Spain, he dreamed of a great red wine.
Oh.
You know, as one might do. Inspiration struck. But it was here in this sherry cellar, say that 10 times fast, and he was smelling American oak and had never quite had that smell of new American oak and wine together.
Huh.
Right? It's like that's not going to happen everywhere.
Yeah.
But he then traveled to Bordeaux and relished in Cab Sauv and Merlot.
Hmm.
So he's got all this swirling around in his head. And with that in his brain, he goes back to Australia to his employer, Penfolds, with his dream of making a great Australian red.
So he was not sleeping in the sherry cellar.
I don't know. He might have gotten kicked out. The details are a little murky. You can't sleep here, sir. but so he's back in Australia with Penfolds. And the problem is that Australia did not have any small new oak barrels. Very little Cabernet and no Merlot. So he had to do it the Australian way, and he would use the best Shiraz he could find. And so there happened to be two old vineyards and cooler sites near Adelaide that would, right? So he had to beg and borrow new barrels and managed to find five fairly small American oak barrels. Lucky guy, but only five. So here we have Max. He's got this vision based on a Bordeaux that he was going to have to execute in an uniquely Australian way. And he would call it Grange Hermitage.
Mm.
So Grange was the name of the original Dr. Penfold's house. And Hermitage was the most famous Shiraz vineyard in France, a.k.a. Syrah. So the first Grange was made in 1951. But it wasn't until 1960 that the wine began to throw off and get rid of its dark tannins and exhibit its true flavors, like cedar, blackcurrant, tar. You know, so it was truly an original. Smoke, leather, licorice, it had all the things. But since it tasted so tough and impenetrable when it was young, it almost didn't happen. And in 1957, Penfolds ordered Max to stop making it. just quit. But Max actually kept on making it, hiding it in the dark corners of the cellar where management never went. So doing this in secret. And in 1960, he could finally show off the 1951 that he had made.
Wow.
And this ushered in the modern wine age for Australia.
Mm.
So his secret long-term project. Yeah. Has a lot of guts. And
he did not take no for an answer.
Yeah.
Wow. It all started in a sherry cellar.
Yeah.
All right, so now we're going to move on. We're going to get a little bit of a court case going here. So the court case is J. Bollinger versus Costa Brava Wine Company. So to set the stage, we have a guy named Michael Grills, and he was a student. He was coming home after spending a summer holiday on the Costa Brava in Spain. and he thought up a brilliant plan. He had tasted wonderful sparkling wine called Perolada while he was on vacation in Spain. And so, I mean, like all college students, right? Came home from study abroad, drank a lot of wine, had this great business plan.
Yeah. I'm cultured.
So in 1958, he founded the Costa Brava Wine Company. And his idea was to import this Perolada, which was a fizzy Spanish wine, but he was going to call it Spanish Champagne. Mm-hmm. But this wasn't a new idea. He had precedents for this. So Britain had been importing a bunch of Spanish wine, and they had been calling it Spanish Burgundy, Spanish Graves, Spanish Sauternes for generations. So this wasn't anything new that he was planning. It was just new that he was using champagne. But a significant number of important British wine merchants did a lot of their business with these Spanish knockoffs. So, not a crazy idea, but this was his plan. And so there was problems with this, right? The English jury found the Costa Brava Wine Company not guilty. No one thought he was doing anything wrong from the British perspective, because they were all doing it.
Yeah, and had for like centuries.
Yes,
yeah.
But not so much the French. And so they had made good progress in enforcing their laws about the appellation of origin. And so then, to them, it really mattered, not only in France, but worldwide. And so this is the first time someone in Britain had degraded the term champagne by applying it to wines of a completely different geographical province. So they wanted to stop this, right? They wanted to stop it before it got out of hand. This is the first one. They're going to like nip it in the bud and be done. Champagne relied very heavily on exports for its profits. And so they figured to get this to stop, they had to set a legal precedence. So that they could fight producers in other countries and everywhere else trying to use the term champagne for their domestic product. So in 1960, the champagne exporters, led by Bollinger, brought a new action to try and establish that they collectively and exclusively owned the right to the name champagne. A pamphlet was issued by the Costa Brava Wine Company and, quote, said, giving a champagne party, and they were like kind of outlining how to do this, and it was clearly designed to tempt retailers to sell the Spanish Perolada as champagne. And that pamphlet was the final like exhibit that swayed the judge in the case. And so the judge ordered the Costa Brava Wine Company to stop selling their Perolada under any name that included the word champagne. And from that moment onward, the champagne producers have been most energetic in prosecuting anyone outside of champagne making and selling sparkling wine. The U.S. still holds out. There's still a little, like, gray area with U.S. But none of its good bubblies call themselves champagne. Oddly enough, only the cheapest products do. But the Champenois have become relentless in their defense. So some other fun things that they've gone against. There was a champagne shampoo, which that's a mouthful, in Germany that they brought charges against. A champagne deodorant in Austria. Hmm. And even a champagne perfume by Yves Saint Laurent in France. And they were all taken to court over this use. They also sued this guy who was making elderflower champagne in England. So they're relentless for the champagne, even in products that aren't wine, which I found interesting.
Yeah.
Don't want to confuse things.
That's so right.
Don't drink that
shampoo. The whole brand thing.
All right. So we've been to Australia. We've been to England and France. And we are going to come to America tonight. Mm-hmm. So let's start with a little trivia, going way back to the beginnings of the American colonies. But who do you think, like what group of people, were the first to try to establish a New York wine industry? way back in the 1640s.
The Dutch?
Yeah, look at that. Yeah, it was the Dutch. Then the English tried, and everyone so far is failing. Like, we know now with our modern lens, it was because of phylloxera, but New York also had an extra problem, and that is just
cold.
cold
climate there.
Yeah. So the problem of the cold was partially solved by a guy named Philip Wagner. He was a grape grower in Maryland who pioneered hybridizing crossings of European and local vines. And then in 1952, there was a man named Constantine Frank who took a bus from New York City to Geneva in the heart of New York's what will become main wine region, the Finger Lakes, or maybe, yeah. So the Finger Lakes, well, I haven't been there, but everybody else has. So don't let me tell you, but it's a group of deep glacial lakes just south of Lake Ontario. So they have relatively warm waters that allow all vineyards to be planted on their shores. And our man, Constantine Frank, was determined to prove that classic Vitis vinifera varieties of Burek could work in New York State. So he wasn't just regular Constantine Frank. No, he was Dr. Constantine Frank. And he got on that bus to head to the New York State Agriculture Experiment Station in Geneva because he wanted to try to get a job there working on vine research. So he had a doctorate from Odessa University in the Ukraine, and his thesis was on growing high-quality Vitis vinifera grapes in cold climates. Like, who better for the job, right?
Perfect.
So he had grown vinifera in Russia, where the temperature went to 40 below, and there's a quote that we had to bury the entire vine in the winter, where when we spit, it froze before it hit the ground. But he didn't get the job. They actually put him to work hoeing blueberries instead. Mm. And it might have had something to do with the fact he could hardly speak English, and it was the 1960s. But eventually, word about this crazy Ukrainian guy gets out to Charles Fournier, who was boss of a wine company called Gold Seal. And he had been chief winemaker at in France. And he wanted to make champagne. He was eager to plant vinifera grapes here. So Frank persuaded Fournier that in areas where the ground froze, the secret was to find these really hardy roots that you could graft the sensitive vinifera vines to. And so they set off across the American Northeast to find something that would fit the bill. And they got lucky in a convent in Quebec. So, in Quebec, they had a winter climate even worse than New York, and the convent was able to produce wine from Pinot Noir vines 1 year in three. So, that's not so bad odds, I guess, in agriculture.
Yeah, and with Pinot Noir either.
Yeah. So, they went back to Gold Seal, and they grafted these vines onto Canadian roots because they were hardier, cold-resistant wood, and they grafted on Riesling and Chardonnay, but also Gewurztraminer and Cab. And in 1957, the temperatures dropped to minus 13 degrees, and a lot of the native vines were killed. But the Riesling and Chardonnay on the Canadian rootstocks showed less than 10% damage, and at vintage produced a healthy crop of 3 to 4 tons an acre. Frank's biggest triumph, though, came when his 1961 Riesling
Trockenbeerenauslese.
Thank you. The longest word I've ever seen.
Trockenbeerenauslese.
Yeah. His sweet wine was served at the White House in 1961. Oh, good job, Frank.
Yeah. And the winery is still there, so go visit.
Yeah, we just did a few weeks ago.
All right, we're going to stay in America. We're going to head to the other coast. We're going to head over to California. So the first people to make decent quality mass market wines for the table were the Americans, obviously. Let's mass market everything, right? And so we're going to focus on Gallo. If anyone has gone to the grocery store and seen the double bottles of wine. So Gallo had focused on volume, domination of the market, pursuit of profit, and that made ENJ Gallo the biggest winery in the world. They actually lost that title to the Constellation brand in 2004, but right, we're still in the 1900s. They did look at improving vineyards and winemaking, but they also focused on marketing, and that's kind of where the play is here. They produced a 300-page manual on how to sell wine, so some of their tips and tricks. 7 foot across is the widest the human eyes can take in at one go. So make all of your Gallo bottle displays in a store 7 foot across. Hmm. That was one of their...
That's true.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'll test that.
Yeah, we need to fact check. But these are quotes, so we don't have to fact check this. put highly advertised bottles at eye level, impulse purchases at waist level, biggest bottles to the right of the smaller bottles. So it'd be interesting to see if that's how it is. It's still at the grocery store.
Hmm.
But Gallo was started by two brothers, Ernest and Julio, in 1933. So just before Prohibition ended, which is interesting to start a wine business during that time. But they did it to sell bulk wine. And within 3 years, they built a winery with a 1.5 million gallon capacity. And they started bottling their wine in 1938. And by 1950 is when they had the largest winery in America, which lasted until 2004.
Wow.
It wasn't until the 1960s, though, that kind of change swept across the area and kind of the marketing in America. So up until that point, they had made stuff like Night Train and Thunderbird, if anyone was drinking prior to the 60s. no. Not here. Maybe somebody, right? But they, in the 60s, they see this new generation growing up who wanted to drink table wines with their meals. So Julio Gallo offered growers long-term contracts at fixed prices to plant better grape varieties, which was kind of new at that time and really good on him, right? He brought in stainless steel tanks. He started making ambergris flavor guard. Those in quotes, you couldn't see me do that. But bottles to guard against oxidation. Conveniently, they also had their own bottling factory. So they kind of started the green glass for that. And they started to refine their blending. So... at this point, we have their, like, 60s wine is the Hardy Burgundy. Yeah. They got by with using the, and I think it's still for sale, actually. I think it's still called Hardy Burgundy. But, so it's just funny because, like, I know, but who hasn't started, you know, in their 20s drinking the Magnum bottles of Gallo? And funny story, the Wine Mouse, we did a blind tasting test with our friends in our 20s. Mm-hmm. When we
early 20s
when we didn't know any better. and actually in the blind tasting, everybody brought wine and it was a Gallo that won the taste test from all of our young 20-year-old friends.
And it was not a Magnum. It was a regular taste wine. But I mean, it's convenient. It's accessible, it's on sale frequently.
That's true. So, that's very true.
Yeah. Consistent product. Well, so kind of just to round out this time period tonight, but this era was marked by a lot of technological advances. So probably, I don't want to say anything sweeping, like more than any other time, but like there's a lot going on worldwide, right? Like, and just changes in packaging and stuff is happening in post war times. But so for wine, though, because that's all we care about, during this era, we get the Tetra brick carton that was introduced by the Swedes in 1963. So it's usually a rectangular shape and usually a liter in size, and the seal can protect wine because it's, you know, everything else, it's preventing air contact. So we have that back in 1963. Thank you. Also, bag and box. So a guy named Thomas Angrove, a winemaker from Renmark, South Australia, was the first guy to invent cask wine packaging. And it was patented April 20th, 1965. Mm. And in 1967, Charles Malpas and Penfold Wines patented a plastic, airtight, tap welded to a metallized bladder-like bag, right? So there's a lot of words to describe something we all know instantly. And this made storage more convenient. It made pouring easier and spillage less likely.
Hmm.
So
it's hard to imagine a boxed wine in a bag without the pour spout.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And also thinking that it was back in the 1960s.
Yeah, it's not a new thing.
Yeah. They've been slapping the bag since 1967. Or 67. But it's, you know, we've often heard that Australians are kind of leading the charge with like closures and different things and, you know, with the
Selvins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting that even the bags and boxes can go back to that. So,
yeah.
Hmm.
And that's that. We do have some food pairings we'd like to talk about tonight. So one of the first wines we talked about was the Grange Hermitage or
Hermitage. I always think of, because that's probably a really big wine. So I always think of lamb.
A little tiny baby lamb.
They're back.
Maybe not those, but
I think
lamb.
Yeah.
Or like earthy mushroom kind of dishes like that.
Yeah.
Or stews.
Yeah.
Like, you know, cassoulet comes.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some tartare.
Mm. I just envisioned us having a word cloud from our podcast all year, and baby lamb would be like.
It would be the top.
The biggest word.
It would.
Yeah, can we make that happen?
We actually ate at a restaurant in Geneva,
ooh,
New York, recently, and we had venison tartare. And I don't remember what it was paired with.
It was not a Shiraz.
No, but it was
a Rioja.
Okay, it was, but
gotcha.
Still American,
yeah.
Yep.
Big red,
yep,
wine, so
yep,
could work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So what's our next little
thing about venison? So our next food pairing will be with cava to celebrate the
Spanish champagne.
Well, it's sparkling, so it goes,
yeah,
with anything.
Yeah. The best cava.
Patatas bravas.
And the food pairing I've ever had was at a champagneria or cavaria in Barcelona, and they had like €3 bottles of cava paired with these little sandwiches.
Mm.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Good.
What kind of sandwiches?
I don't even remember. The sandwiches were not important. But it was
something
like
to coat
good
the stomach.
Spanish
crusty
ham.
Bread. Yeah, it was like a crusty bread, ham, and cheese.
Yeah.
I think it was,
yeah,
maybe butter.
I'm thinking of like a tortilla, you know, like the egg,
yeah,
dish, not the,
yeah,
flour thing, but
with the potatoes,
with the potatoes, yeah, and all that. I think, mm-hmm, that would, yeah.
Yeah.
Lovely cava.
Can't go wrong. I mean, the potato chips.
Yeah.
I don't know, anything.
Yeah.
We talked about.
And for the record, cava is better than Prosecco, but no offense to the Italians, but.
I agree. All right. So our next one, New York Riesling.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. Since we just recently had a lot of New,
yeah,
York Riesling. Obviously, for me, sushi is something I love. And also sushi rolls with a little bit of spice to kind of pair there. I would say as we head into fall, Riesling is perfect for Thanksgiving. Probably goes well with your turkey and like your cranberry, with the cranberry relish, mm-hmm, and with sweet potatoes and pumpkin dishes. And depending on the sweetness level, it could be something that goes with dessert,
mm-hmm,
like pumpkin pie.
Yeah, mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah.
Or if you happen to have a schnitzel handy,
yeah,
you can.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Always,
yeah,
have a schnitzel handy. well, and you know us, we always like to bring up Riesling with Thai food or anything spicy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That spice and acidity goes really well.
Yeah.
All right, next up is our Gallo Red Blend.
Mm.
Right.
I like to pair that with a grocery store. Just leave it there.
Yeah, absolutely. Or the kitchen sink, pouring it down the drain.
But if you have to, I mean, if you're gonna buy,
yeah,
one, then I mean,
maybe make sangria with it.
Yeah, sangria.
Add a little bit of extra liquor and,
yeah,
some fruit. Perfect.
Yeah, I was about to say. Also, I feel like some of the cheaper red generic blends Could also be for a meal that's like super busy.
Yeah.
Where you don't want to like.
Yeah, doesn't want to overpower.
Actually take away. Like if there's just so much going on, you just need something to drink.
Yeah. It's like a lunch meal or something.
Yeah.
Like a weekend lunch.
Or if you're having like your in-laws over that you
Or like people you know that's just going to drink all your wine and not appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like if you're planning.
Give them that and then you can drink something nice like a New York Riesling.
Yeah, put it in a different.
Or have it as like the third bottle of wine open with it.
Put that in the carafe and they can just pour out of that.
Yeah.
So, this is our table wine for this evening.
And this one kind of goes hand in hand with that, but boxed wine.
Yeah. Well, and I think
it depends on what your boxed wine is, though. Like if it's Franzia, then it's the same thing that we just talked about. But if it's like decent boxed wine, then no. I mean, there's nothing wrong with boxed wine. It's just. What's the quality of the wine that's in the box?
Yeah.
And
everybody has to start somewhere. And that's okay. You drink what you like. And
it keeps the wine fresh longer.
So you can have like a glass of wine and hold on to it, you know.
So my pairing with a boxed wine or our pairing would be for an adventure. Because like you just sometimes need wine that is easy on the go. And
I will say recently at the beach we had like, you know, our cart with the cooler full of beer and everything, and we literally just took the bladder out of the box and put it in the cooler.
Yeah. It didn't get like torn on ice.
No. So you just pour it in your cup.
It's genius.
It's a good thing to do it. No glass at the beach.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And one last pairing is you with us on November 14th, 15th, and 16th. So please take our class. We're going to be teaching a little crash course into how it's made, holiday edition. So we're going to be talking about celebratory wines to help gear up and get ready for Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's Eve. We'll be talking about like celebratory wines
and how they're made
and dabble in the food pairing part. But mostly production. And of course, get to drink wine.
Yeah.
It's going to be like 3 nights in a row. Little crash course, so coming out with us.
Yeah, and you can find information on our website or our social medias, but the class is through Davidson Davie Community College.
All right, sounds like a fun time. We did the summer camp back in August, and it was a blast, so.
Yeah.
All right.
Excellent. Well, we definitely covered a lot of ground and stayed in the 1900s.
Yeah.
The mid-1900s. So this is very exciting. Jesse and Jessica, thank you very much.
Thanks.
You can find out more information about the Wine Mouths by going to their website, winemouths.com, or on Facebook and Instagram at Wine Mouths. That's WineMouths. And now, back to the show.
All right, so we're back here with Jan. So Jan, earlier you mentioned, you know, of course you have the estate vineyard and you also work with about 9 other vineyards in the area. Talk to us about what grape growing is like here in this part of North Carolina in the Upper Hiawassee AVA.
The Upper Hiawassee AVA is in a unique position. We have anywhere from vineyards that are at 1,800 feet of elevation to 2,200, 2,300. So it's a wide range. What primarily grows here well, from my standpoint, is the Native Americans and the hybrids. Vinifera can be difficult because there are some years we have no 90 degree heat days, and a lot of grapes need that 90 degrees to actually get ripe enough in order to have the sugars that you want in them to harvest. But this AVA, what I like about it is the fact that it goes across state lines. One of the things that my husband and I did when we were going around, and one of the things I would say to people is, how come there's no AVA out here? And then I would say, but why is it that we are so similar to North Georgia? Why would we not be part of an AVA that went into North Georgia as well as Western North Carolina? It seems strange to me that, you know, an AVA should stop at a border. And I spoke to a lot of vineyard and winery owners at the time, and I really like to think that I planted that seed of the Upper Hiawassee Highlands. And we were around and in working with the process. We hadn't opened yet, but we had the vineyard and we were in the discussions when they were setting up the AVA. So it was a lot of fun.
I can imagine so. I mean, and like you said, an AVA shouldn't stop at state borders because climate, soil, geography, geology, it all crosses the borders. And I think you see that in this AVA specifically.
Right. And that's what's important to us.
And that was North Carolina's first AVA that crossed state lines. And then there was later a second AVA that crossed state lines twice with Virginia and Tennessee.
And I wonder if they would have done it had this one not gone across state lines.
Maybe not. But it's a similar reasoning there. Their climate with northeast Tennessee and southwest Virginia is very similar to northwest North Carolina. And so
that's right.
Made sense.
It made perfect sense. Absolutely.
So back to the vineyards question. So you work with about 9 other vineyards in the area that you mentioned. What are some of the things that you notice coming in from those vineyards that help supplement what you have as well? Do you notice differences in quality or differences in fruit characteristics?
What I notice is that they need Kurt to help them. He's very good. One of the reasons we have a vineyard is so that he knows what it takes to grow, you know, what kind of spray regime you need, you know, what varieties can take what chemicals at what time, and that whole area is very important to grape growing. And so he works with some of the different vineyards that we have, that we work with, and helps them understand what pressures they're getting and what they may need to spray.
Oh, cool.
I'm not saying all of them need that,
sure.
But there are a few of the smaller growers that, you know, they need that. And then there's one that we do the spraying for them towards the end of the season. They don't want to, they would prefer Kurt to do the final couple spraying so that they're not interfering with when to harvest based on the number of days that you have to, because all these chemicals have certain number of days before you can harvest. But that's the other thing, is that I won't say that we go and we pick at every vineyard that we work with, but if they need help, we go out and we pick with them so that we're actually field sorting and picking out any rot, if there is any, so we know what the quality of those grapes are going to be when they show up at the doorstep, because we were out there picking them.
So how many tons are you dealing with each season then? Obviously, it's going to depend on the weather.
Depends on the weather. It depends on the availability of the grapes. I would say that last year we got about 3.5 tons, and that's unusual, but it was a really good year for getting grapes, and we'll just have to see what we're going to end up with this year. We can put up batches that are anywhere from 12 cases to as many as about 90 cases. And we do all the bottling pretty much ourselves. We get a little bit of help sometimes.
Well, it's always good to have help. And I want to just mention, too, I think it's great that you work with the other growers in the area to help them elevate their quality, because not only does it help your wine, but it helps everyone else's wine and everyone else that's producing. If we can kind of elevate that to say, well, okay, I'm not going to just harvest at a low Brix. I'm going to wait till it's better. And to do that, I'm going to lower my disease pressure. I'm going to treat differently. I'm going to have different viticulture techniques to get there. So I think it's a great thing that you're doing.
Yeah, we're trying to promote the industry as much as we possibly can and be there for anybody who wants to grow the grapes. One of the things that I see, we're lucky, we're up on steep slope with our grapes. But and we've been offered property. There's so many people who are like, oh, I've got this farm. Come plant your grapes here. We'd love to have them. And I'm like, it's bottom land.
Yeah.
No. Grapes don't like bottom land.
Yeah.
They don't like the water to sit on them. They don't like the air to the air to sit on them when it's cold. They want drainage.
Yeah.
And, so site selection is just so very important. And I've actually had people come in here telling me they were going to grow grapes, and the first thing I ask them is, well, where are you going to grow them, and how are you going to grow them? You know, are you talking about bottomland, or are you talking about something that's got a little bit of slope?
Yeah, what's your sun exposure and all right. that? Those are key things to ask as well. So
right.
So let's talk a little bit about the wines then. So kind of walk us through what wines are typically available when folks come to visit.
Well, it depends on, you know, what we've gotten out of the tanks, of course. But right now we have our Vidal Blanc, which is all that we grow. It's all from our estate grown. We've looked to buy some additional Vidal Blanc, but not been successful. We have some Cayuga White that is a grape that is grown in our AVA, even though it's grown over in Georgia. We have a Sauval Blanc, which is local from two different vineyards, one here in Andrews, one Beaver Dam Vineyards out in Unaka. And we've been making a Sauval Blanc that we soak in peaches. That's our sweet peachy wine. Catawba is grown locally by Joel Franks, and we have that in the tasting room. We get a lot of Cynthiana, which even though it's an inky grape, if you do whole cluster pressing, you can make a rosé out of it.
Oh.
It's a dark rosé, but it's still a rosé. So we always have that in the tasting room. Our Mountain Wood, of course, is our Cynthiana. That's probably what I consider to be our flagship red. And then the other one that you'll always find is our blackberry, pretty much blackberry blueberry. That the blackberries I go out and hand pick, and then the blueberries we try to find a source. This year, the one that is in process, we actually found a grower here in North Carolina that we could buy from.
Oh, cool! That's awesome.
So it's a total North Carolina product. So maybe we'll put that in the state fair next year,
yeah.
or the wine competition,
right.
or whatever it
right.
happens
Definitely.
To be.
So talk about some of the awards that these wines have won.
Okay, well, the first time that we did our Cayuga White, it won double gold. Unfortunately, since it wasn't a North Carolina product, even though it was in our AVA, you know, we couldn't go for best of show. But the Lace White is back, and I think it's really good this year. It's a little on the drier side. Our Sauval Blanc that we got also got double gold, but that was last year. That was the Sauval Blanc that we got from locally. Our Royal White consistently gets gold and silver medals. Our Cynthiana that's in the Mountain Wood generally gets silver or bronze medals. So we've done rather well. My husband one time asked me why I named the Royal White, the Vidal Blanc, the Royal White. And then it started winning gold medals. And he said, now I know why you named it that. Another one that we generally have, we'll be bringing it back into the tasting room pretty soon, is our Southern Lady, which is our Chardonnay, which we grow and also get from a vineyard that's out in Asheville. And that one is a proverbial favorite of everyone because Chardonnay tastes so much like Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, it's name recognition, I guess. But everybody's looking for that Chardonnay-type wine.
Right.
We use all stainless steel fermentation for our whites and also our aging, and as well as our rosés. So they do present fruit forward because they never go through a secondary fermentation to take out that fruit. And that's what we like.
Yeah, and I think that helps embrace some of the freshness, the fruitiness of those, because those varieties can have such a great spectrum of flavors and aromas.
Right. Of course, we do use oak for our reds.
Typically, how long are you aging the reds in oak? It depends on.
Well, it depends a little bit, but I'll tell you a good story about that. My husband bought new American oak barrels back in 17, and we put in the Merlot that we had gotten from North Georgia, and we put in the Cynthiana that we got from ourselves and as well as Beaver Dam. 2 years later, he took them out of the barrels. The Cynthiana came out going, man, bring it on. I got it. I love it. Just bring it on. Merlot came out going, please, 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 no. So we ended up going and buying some Cab Franc from North Georgia and blending that in and putting that in new American oak. Neutral oak for a year. The other one had been in for for 2 years and then blending them.
Okay.
And that's what we have for our Tassel Red. But it was a contrast of grapes in New American Oak and what they came out as.
Yeah, Cynthiana seems to like American Oak.
It does.
It would make sense, right? It's a Native American grape, so it would make sense that that would work well together. So.
And it's good that you let them go a little bit longer, too, to kind of tame down and mellow out a little bit. Sometimes they can have a little bit of that higher acidity and some complexities there, mm-hmm. but when you age it, it just rounds it out. And I'm sure it took really well to the American oak to kind of just latch on and say, more.
Yeah, it did. And I'm glad. I mean, that's one of the things that we try to age our reds for quite a while. We don't rush anything into the bottle. That's why I tell you it's very good that Kurt is as patient as he is. He won't rush. He won't even rush a white into a bottle.
That's a good thing.
So if we're out of it, we're out of it. You know, here on my side, I'm going. When are we bottling?
Yeah.
He's going, it's not ready. It's not ready.
Be patient.
Be patient.
So what else would you like folks to know about Ferncrest?
What I'd like people to know is that we are very interested in the environment, environmental issues. We put our money where our mouth is, I guess you could say, with having a passive solar house as well as the winery is passive solar, as well as having the solar power and now solar power here. We just believe that we need to be good stewards of our environments. We don't try to overspray our grapes, just give them what they need when they need it. We try to be minimalist when it comes to additives to our wines. That's one of the reasons why Kurt takes a long period of time to get them ready to go in the bottle, because he wants to make sure that they have gone through as much natural settling, fining as possible before we do anything else to them. And we work with, actual fruit. I mean, when we make a wine that has peaches in it or it has blackberries, blueberries, we're using fresh products. We're not using concentrate or adding any of the other things that some other wineries will add. Not that it's a bad thing, but we're actually using fruit.
Yeah, that's your choice. I think it shows too.
Yeah.
Well, tell folks how they can find you physically and virtually, and if there's anything else you want to cover.
Yeah. Well, we have a website. It's www.ferncrestwinery.com, and we do ship. I would like people to know that. So any state that will accept shipments, we do use a service by the name of Vino Shipper, but from our website, the page that has current list of products, it has a button that you can go directly to Vino Shipper and buy the wine. We also have a Facebook page and an Instagram account, so you can look for us, Ferncrest Winery, on both of those and like us and see what's going on. We're having music right now on Sunday's afternoons. We were having it outside, but with the heat and humidity coming in for next week, we're going to have it inside this right now. It'll continue until October 1st, but then we're going to start up again the last weekend in October and go through at least November, possibly the first weekend in December, with, again, the Sunday afternoons. And it'll be outside when it's nice, and it'll be inside when it's not, because we've got plenty of room in here to have folks as well as music.
And folks can find you physically in downtown Andrews.
In downtown Andrews, we're at the corner of Cherry and Main, and that's 1060 Main Street. If you come into Andrews, it's not really hard to find Main Street.
No. it's kind of the main drag, if you will. So
it's the main drag.
Yeah, it's very easy. And then look for the grapevine, and then you'll know those. And certainly if you follow the Facebook page and Instagram, Jan always is posting pictures about how that grapevine is doing and the grapes throughout the season. So it's always fun to see that. So, excellent.
Jan, we definitely appreciate it. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate you taking your time to let me do this.
That's it for this episode of Cork Talk.
Thanks again to Jan. We appreciate her taking the time to talk with us, and we encourage everyone to plan a visit to downtown Andrews, North Carolina to visit them.
If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and a review. It helps others find Cork Talk and lets us know how we can improve.
And don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at NC Wine Guys. Until next time, and remember, a cork only talks when it's out of the bottle. Cheers!
This episode is made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council.